retail ice age. There's no question that there's a slowdown.
Signs yet again that retail sales are not up to speed.
Why aren't Americans shopping more?
The consumers are gasping for air right now, but this is an indication of how much the consumer is struggling.
Most of the country is feeling the pain of that in terms of depressed wages and depressed disposable income.
There was always this concern that it would hit both the high-end and the low-end retailers. So what we're looking at now is a retail massacre.
Because of the specter of deflation, the capital investing is slowing down in the marketplace. That's usually a precursor to a recession.
The retail ice age. We're in it.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Another bad week for stocks, third week in a row as stock prices head down and technicians are turning cautious. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. In hour one, my good friend Ralph Ancampora will be joining us. Ralph is one of the last remaining bulls, but, you know, that bull side may be changing to bearish. Ralph wants to see a couple things hold if he's to stay in that bullish camp. That's coming up in the first hour. And Greg Weldon will be joining us as we talk about some real danger points that point to more slowdown in the economy, especially with the consumer, and why Greg is very bullish on gold. And of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week. All that coming up in hour one.
And I'm John Loeffler. You know, the economy has been slowing down since the second quarter of 2015, and now the labor market is showing signs of weakness. The real question is, where are we headed? That's basically the big subject of the big picture today. We'll take several different slices at that topic. Is this really as good as it gets as we plod possibly towards a recession maybe sometime next year? And what are the risks and what are the areas that you can make investments that will still work? Speaking of that, there's a debt super cycle, and part of the question that we're asking today is whether or not we're at the end of a debt super cycle, and then what does it look like when you get to the end of a debt super cycle? Because it seems like central banks are still trying to print money. They've been trying all sorts of things, and very little is working. And what are they going to do during the next downturn to try to stimulate everything and get the economy or economies working again? All of that, the subject of the big picture coming up later on today. And as is our wont here, we start the program with Ryan Poplava. Ryan, a bit up and down this week, but if we look over the last 3 weeks, the market has tracked lower consistently for those 3 weeks. So we have three in a row right here. And you've been mentioning for the last couple of weeks in our conversations that we may be in store for a correction. So, question, have there been any fundamental catalysts that have brought us to this point?
So far, John, this has mainly been a correction, I would say, in time and less on price. You hear correction, everyone mainly thinks 10% bull market corrections. Are we in store for that? I don't know yet. So far, it seems to me that we've been pretty resilient. We've come into some major support areas. A week ago, it was a 50-day moving average on the S&P. We rallied, and we still held roughly around that area. But, you know, since the recent high a couple of weeks ago when I took some exposure off for my clients, the market really is only down 2.5%. So, like I said, very resilient. Back to your question, I think the reasoning behind it has been a little bit more technically based than I would say fundamentally based. You know, at 2100, you know, we were near resistance, a resistance that we have not been able to get above for the past three attempts above 2100, that level now. So pretty key level as I technically look at it. And the other thing too is valuations, right? I've talked about valuations a lot. I've talked about earnings a lot this year. We've been in basically an earnings recession. Earnings have been falling for the past few quarters. Currently, those estimates are starting to come up a little bit for 2016's earnings. Now the consensus is right around $123 for the S&P 500. Price at 2100, you're basically looking at a 17 multiple. Is that a lot, John? No, it's not, but it is up there. So it's not excessive. It's not panicky levels. The year 2000, those kind of levels of multiples that we saw in the S&P, we're not anywhere near that, but at the same time, we are elevated. And given where, you know, those concerns have been over earnings over the last many quarters, you know, looking at valuations levels, investors are very conscientious of it.
Yeah, you know, we've had mixed economic numbers over the last couple of weeks, and I'm wondering if that doesn't play some kind of a part in this consolidation.
It does. I mainly believe it's technically based. This little sideways correction, we're working off a lot of the overbought readings. We rallied very sharply, as you recall, from February, with really no breaks. It was just a one-way move. But yeah, looking at the economic numbers, really other than the employment data, most of the numbers have actually been good. Durable goods orders last week, services last week, and then this week, the retail sales number, the sentiment numbers suggest things are fine. The employment data is concerning, though, to me, and I'm looking at something of a bit of a trend here since the October highs. In the monthly data, we've been seeing some deceleration there. So we have not been increasing at the rate that we were all the way in October, and we've seen a steady decline in the rate of job adds. The other thing, too, this week, the jobless claims number out on Thursday, it's a weekly number that comes out for last week's results, kicked it up a notch. Currently, at the highest levels we've seen for initial claims since January, when we really started to get into some concerns about the economy early January. And I think the dollar has, I would say, contributed on top of the economic news recently with the employment data, with the technical issues being near resistance. I think the dollar has contributed to this sort of sideways correction here, up 8 of the last 9 trading days, John. So if you recall, I talked a lot about the dollar over the past few months, and especially last year. The dollar was in almost a cyclical trend. It was rising considerably from July in 2014, if I recall, when central banks' policies diverged. European Central Bank went one way, Bank of Japan went one way, all easing, and the U.S. had been trying to remove some of its accommodation, removing QE, and then trying to raise interest rates. A lot of that discussion over the past couple of years has been that. And that's what's contributed to the strength in the dollar. Strength in dollars has hurt commodities. It's really, really hurt the energy sector. Obviously, the other thing hurting the energy sector was oversupply. So those two factors really hurt earnings for the S&P 500. Anything attributed to energy, which is a significant amount just due to its weighting. But the other was multinational companies. If you heard from earnings results over the past year, starting in 2015, early in 2015, we were hearing companies say that their earnings were being hurt by the dollar. And that was the main catalyst for that weakness in earnings. So since the rally began in February, the dollar has been in a clear downtrend, what I'd say is an intermediate term trend. So from February to about a month ago-ish, the dollar has been declining, and that has helped feed back into those worry areas that we had, energy, multinationals. Those have come back very much in this rally since February. Normally, we'd see multinationals and commodities correct, right? If the dollar is rising, and that's what the dollar has been doing as of late. But interestingly, commodities are hanging in there, John, especially, I'd say, oil and gold. Oil is up due to some fundamental factors. The Canadian wildfires that started last week was shut in of production. You know, recently we saw some results from the IEA report that basically highlighted they're expecting better global growth demand. It was better than expected. As well as the inventory data we got midweek was very strong. There was a draw on inventories. So those three catalysts played into oil strength this week. But normally, you know, we expect the market to go up with that oil strength. And it did initially this week. But I think the market took, you know, a turn more recently due to some of the earnings results we heard from retailers. But anyways, you know, gold initially fell on the rising dollar, but has found some technical support around, you know, its recent breakout point. So it's hanging in very tough with the rise in the dollar. It's not really paying it too much heed. You know, the dollar's been rising since we got some decent economic results, and that started on May 3rd with the ISM services report. But, you know, recently, too, there has been a lot of verbal intervention by Japan's finance minister. If you recall, John, I thought that the biggest macro event in the last few weeks has been the Bank of Japan, their announcement to not do anything on the 28th, really threw the markets off, especially in the currency markets. We saw a very big rally in the yen, and that hurt the dollar initially. But since that, I think they're trying to rein in the market's response. And we saw that from the ECB, Mario Draghi, back in February. Same thing, where they had to kind of pare back market's expectations. So although this has been going on, the dollar strength, a lot of the people, the technicians I talked to feel that that's playing a lot into this recent market consolidation. But I think, you know, going back to the Bank of Japan being the major catalyst right now, until we see the Fed in June and possibly July, they are the next major catalyst, I think, for the dollar and for the markets. And we'll hear, I think, essentially of what their policies are going to be at the G7 meeting, which will take place the following weekend and also at the end of May. So those are the two major catalysts I'm watching right now.
All right, let's change topics a bit. Let's look at retail stocks, Ryan. We got horrible earnings recently from companies this week, but then there were really strong retail sales figure on Friday. The market still fell Friday, regardless of those economic results. But then what's the story here?
Great question. And it's one that's actually been really bothering me as of late, based on these earnings results and the economic, like you just mentioned, very strong retail sales figures. You know, what gives on Friday? You know, it's been bothering me so much that the consumer discretionary space was hit very hard this week. But I think some of that is secular driven as well as micro driven instead of macro, macro being the economic news that we're getting. Looking at the secular theme here, John, sales continue to be pushed more into the internet space, and especially for any specialty company with a strong internet presence, and away from the department stores. I've been hearing that mall traffic continues to drop. Interestingly, what I did hear is that strip mall shopping centers traffic there has been going up. You know, I don't know what's going on there, why the public are steering further away from malls. Maybe it's just too big of a crowd. I don't know. But earnings this week, they were horrible, especially in apparel. But overall, I believe in that whole space, retailing, restaurants, the consumer discretionary space, the sector, a lot of it right now is it's a stock picker's market. You got to pick the right one, obviously. The discrepancy between performance between one retailing stock and another, the gap is huge. And there are a lot of stories that are working and many that aren't, many restaurants that are working, many that aren't. And I continue to hear about store closings from department stores. So that's definitely a secular theme. So there's a lot going on in retail, but right now apparel seems to be an area that has had some pretty big weakness.
Well, the impression you get from all of this is that there's a lot of turmoil in this sector. And if you're trying to invest, how do you actually do that and be confident you're making the right investments?
It is a sector of the S&P, so many managers who are trying to benchmark the performance are still going to invest in that area. Where you can create alpha, obviously, is finding the companies that are performing better if you're an individual investor, investing in individual securities, rather. You know, you simply have to do your homework. That's easy to say. You have to look at what companies are growing, which companies are at a value. But you know, John, I've been wondering a lot, like I said, about this sector. What do we do? And if you recall at the end of 2014, and I'll put myself on the spot here, I was on that wagon with the rest of the bulls. I'd say pounding the table. We've got to be bullish on the consumer given lower energy prices. And I definitely fell victim of that. And I am still kind of perplexed by the drop in oil and the drop in retail that I have just had to check with one of Fidelity's senior sector specialists. His name is Brian Sajati this week. And he said that when he spoke with Visa, who has a pretty good idea of what people are spending their money on, right? You know, their analysis of the subject, you know, if we look at oil, the savings from that, surveys that they've run, you know, I don't know how they got this information, but they basically said 50% of the adjustment to the consumer's pocketbook from cheaper gas was spent going into savings, about 25% in paying down debt, and the last, you know, 25% was actually spent on discretionary spending. So that's not a one-to-one relationship with a fall in oil and a rise in consumption. But you know, what he did say, despite oil not being the catalyst that everyone really thought it would be, he said the consumer discretionary group right now is their strongest conviction buy based on all the other factors that really very much contribute to the strength of the consumer. And he named off the accommodative Fed, keeping interest rates low, which we've mentioned many times on the show, unemployment being low, wage growth increasing. I believe when we looked at the employment data last week, John, I mentioned that wage growth is up near 2% year over year, and strong home sales, basically due to supply constraints. So, You know, he also agreed that we continue to see the secular trend of online retailing growing. And in a nutshell, he believes the U.S. consumer is fine. But, you know, that might not be the case for apparel-linked retailers and department stores, clearly this week with the results we've seen.
Well, it sounds like we need to have Brian on the show sometime.
Yeah, I totally agree. Great guy. I'm actually reaching out to him to see if he'd be willing to do that. So hopefully, maybe in the weeks to come, I can get him on the Insider Show during the week and, you know, definitely looking into it.
Okay, sounds good. We'll look forward to that. Any micro catalysts on the radar for the week or even weeks ahead?
The most important, I think, is the Bank of Japan discussions. What are they going to do? They didn't do anything on April 28th. But yet their finance minister is saying otherwise, that they're planning to do more, obviously trying to jawbone the yen down based on its recent strength. And of course, the economic numbers in the next week. We'll get the first look at May activity, which we always get mid-month with the Empire Manufacturing Survey and the Philadelphia Fed Survey. And then obviously, we always get the flash purchasing managers index numbers from the U.S., Europe and Japan. China no longer does it. We only get the month end. But those are pretty important numbers that the market looks at from a macro perspective. And then, you know, we're going to get some more retail earnings next week. I think that will be very important given what we've seen on the micro level this week with apparel and retailers and department stores. Some of them bounce back later in the week based on that strong retail sales number. But as you can see, though, it is concerning. So are we going to roll over? You know, we have not rolled over. Market's down 2.5%. That's a consolidation. That's a correction in time. But if we break some key levels I'm watching 2040 right now with the S&P. If we broke below that, that would be a head and shoulder top on a small time frame. And I'm also watching the 200-day average below that. So there's a few levels that we have great support that would still be constructive towards maybe breaking out of these highs. But, you know, fundamentally, we've had some mixed results. So if we start getting some more negative results, the PMI data figures next week, if those are negative, it's possible we could roll over.
Well, either way, we'll cover it right here on the program. And having said all of that, good weekend.
You too, John. We'll see you next week.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Howard Davidowitz joins us today. He's the chairman of the New York City-based retail consulting and investment banking firm, Davidowitz & Associates. And Howard, a couple of weeks ago, a report was released concluding that major department store chains like Sears, JCPenney, Macy's, and others may have to close up shop on hundreds of locations across the U.S. to reach the same level of profitability that they saw prior to the last recession. And two of the main reasons cited for this were the effect coming from Amazon and a chronic drop in mail shopper traffic. Now, Howard, I know that you've been out front warning on this for some time now. Do you think that this report and the sign that we're seeing of stores closing or announcements of such are just alarmism, or is this really a trend that we should expect to be taking place going forward now?
First of all, I thought the report was absolutely crazy because there's no way those chains can return to their former numbers. So the report was nuts. What's happening now is massive, massive store closings across the board, be it Gap, be it Aeropostale, BB Stores, Staples, Macy's, Kohl's, Penney's. There is massive store closings across the board, be it department stores, which are very weak, be it apparel specialty stores, which are very weak, be it office supply stores, which are a disaster. So there are store closings everywhere. And that's what's going on. And with the article, point to the article, which I thought was patently stupid and ignoramus, was that, oh, yeah, well, we got to close these stores to get back to the level of results we used to have. I thought that was nuts because we'll never get back to the results we used to have. We're living in a different world with online and Amazon. They're never getting back to where they were ever. They've got to close these stores to survive. Gap, terrible. I mean, across the board. So when they say it's bad, they've got to close these stores to survive. So that article, the principal point was totally wrong. They've got to close a lot more stores, and there'll be tons of Pacific Sunwear bankrupt. I mean, Sears is going to end up closing all their stores and all the Kmart stores. How will they get back to their property? None of these companies are getting back to where they were. What they're in is they're in survival mode because so many of their stores have become bad and are losing money. And of course, that will result in accelerated store closings. And they'll have to do that to stay in business. And that's exactly what they're doing.
Well, after a nice run-up of 10 weeks, the S&P is now running into resistance. Is this simply a correction after a nice run-up or the beginning of something more serious? Joining us on the program is Ralph Ancampora. Ralph, as you're looking at this market right now, we're doing very nicely for 10 weeks. The market was going up every single week. Beginning last week, we've been running into some trouble. So is this something serious?
That's a great question, Jim. That's one that I'm pondering right now. You know, a little pullback after a great run from the February lows is just more than necessary. I mean, we need to digest the gains. We need to correct a lot of the overbought conditions, which we're doing, okay? But I'm a little nervous when I see big stock in the Dow like Apple breaking down today. You know, I have targets a lot lower for Apple. I think Apple right now is selling somewhere around $89, and I can make a case for the mid to upper 70s. And, you know, if you get that kind of a breakdown of some of the big Dow stocks, it makes me wonder, especially when I look at the Dow itself, the key support level is the April 7th intraday low, and that was at 17,484.23. Same level on the S&P 500 was 2,033.80. That's the, let me repeat, the April 7th low. I'll stay neutral short term with the expectations of further upside gains as long as we don't close below those levels. If we do, Jim, then I have to reevaluate because I think the market will be vulnerable then.
Ralph, typically as you get towards an end of a bull market or a run, you get this gravitation towards the blue chips. You get the gravitation towards, you know, very safe type stocks, your staples and your utilities. And in this run-up, we had some nice gains in the safer areas in the market. Does that alarm you that we've seen that concentration in that area besides the big run-up that we saw in the things that were beaten up the most, like gold stocks, material stocks, energy stocks? I mean, they've been doing very nicely here.
Actually, the whole run-up was impressive because it was fairly broad-based. Remember at one point, the small and mid-cap stocks were doing very, very well. So there was, in the February to April, May run-up, I was impressed. And I was glad to see that it broadened out. But to follow your point, I think a lot of that is contracted. And we're starting to see some heaviness and breaking down in some of the more aggressive names. And I don't think that bodes well. And yes, I think when you see a gravitation more towards utilities and things like that, that makes you stop and think because my biggest fear and the biggest problem I've had, I think we all have had over a year now, is failed rallies. I think you remember me talking about that throughout 2015, you know, the Dow would get up to its old high and then churn and churn. And, you know, obviously this February through April, May rally, it failed to make another new high. So hopefully we don't get the breakdown. If we do, then I think some of the technical indicators that look like MACD, moving average, convergence, divergence, I like to look at them on a weekly basis. And they're starting to roll over. So it's not very good.
Yeah, because one of the things that I think last time you and I talked, Ralph, that looked so impressive when this rally started from the February lows, it was broad-based. I mean, just about everything was going up. credit spreads narrowed on junk bonds. You had emerging markets taken off, European markets, all the major indexes. So it was broad-based. It just wasn't selective. However, you just bring up something that I find rather interesting, and I don't know if there's a correlation between the two. The Fed ended quantitative easing in November of 2014. And if you look at the market from about 2014 to where we are now, it's almost like we've gone sideways. We'll go up to this level, as you mentioned, but we failed to take out those highs. And then we'll go down, we'll have a correction, especially the big ones that you and I were a little bit concerned about, which was last summer in August and September. We had some serious pullbacks. And then we got up to the beginning of the year. And then, you know, we started the beginning of this year. It looked like things were falling apart. And then all of a sudden, we got that 10-week rally. So is it possible, Ralph, that you could have a sideways correction that is a time-based correction?
Well, that would be the optimum, I think. I was recently with a bunch of great technicians in New York, and we all got together. And I have to say that many of them were bearish. I mean, some severely bearish, and they pointed back to the period you're just talking about, all of 2015 and now early 2016, all that churning. And they look at that as a massive top. And you know, I got to tell you, Jimmy, I can't deny that either. I mean, especially that looks like we're getting another failed rally here. And at best, if that's the case, at best, that wide trading range you're talking about on the downside in February, I think the Dow was somewhere around 15,450 or 15,500. The S&P, I remember, is at 1812. I will never forget that, 1812. So if you wanted to say we're in a wide trading range, that's about the best I can offer, because I do worry about that massive potential top. And I honestly didn't agree with my friends when we were in New York, but I think we're all sitting down now. They'd probably be looking at me, waving their finger at me.
You know, one of the things that we have seen since you and I have been doing these interviews is the market tends to surprise us. I mean, when you take a look at what the market was doing right out of the gates the beginning of the year, it looked like things were falling apart. The economic numbers were looking terrible. And then, of course, we got some stimulus and we got that nice run-up the last time you were on the show that we were talking about. And as you mentioned, it was broad-based. And then when you think everything is just falling apart and rolling over, something happens. Either central bankers do something, the government does something, and all of a sudden perceptions change and the market turns around as it did in February. So is that possible?
Yes, it's possible. But the market has to, and it hasn't done it yet, has to take out all that supply that's been created over the last year or so. And that's the bear argument, and I can't disagree with that. We had a good opportunity to do it right here in the last few weeks, and we seem to be stumbling a little bit. That's a little disturbing. If we can hold above the support level, I was just talking about the April 7th lows, I think we'll have a nice tight trading range right here. And then from here, try to push through to new highs. If you look at a move most people least expect right now, is the Dow and the S&P at all-time new highs. No one's talking about that. Very few people are talking about that. That would be the head fake. I'd love to see it.
You're right, because sentiment has turned bearish. And it's amazing because, do you ever go to, I think it's the SON conference that they have once a year? It's a charity event and they invite, you know, all these top investors from Jeffrey Grunlock to, you know, all the big hedge fund managers. And this year's conference, everybody was there, was bearish. Everybody from Stanley Druckenmiller, Jeffrey Grunlock, there wasn't anybody. I think they found one bull in the whole audience. And sometimes when everybody is bearish, as you well know, Ralph, sometimes that's a good contrary indicator.
Well, that's what happened to me when I was in New York with my buddies. Myself and another fellow were the only two standouts, but looking pretty optimistic on the market. And yeah, I agree. Sentiment on balance is negative. And that's usually, as a contrarian, usually a good sign. But, you know, I have to go with my technical work also. And as I mentioned, I can live with this consolidation that we're doing in the last couple of weeks. That's perfect. But if we start breaking down like Apple's doing now, I'll have to adjust.
So once again, if we can hold the support levels and bounce off that, that's a good sign. So it may be we
continue and do the same thing we've been doing here for the last year. But I'll tell you the things that are starting to concern me now, just from a fundamental point of view, Ralph, is we're seeing a lot of things from the economic indicators. The weaker economic growth, we peaked in the second quarter of last year at 3.8%. Every single quarter, GDP has been going lower. Now, we're still in positive territory, so there are a lot of economists that don't expect a recession, but they didn't expect a recession in 2007. So when you see the economic numbers starting to roll over, usually the market is ahead of those numbers, and maybe that's what we were seeing.
I think you might be right there. You're giving justification for why the market is churning here, and we need that, obviously, because ultimately it's economics that dictates everything anyway. So we need an excuse, that would be it.
Outside of that, let's assume that the market is rolling over here. Let's take the bearish argument that your friends were giving you when you met with them. What would you do defensively if the market was rolling over? Build up cash positions, go to safer securities, buy bonds?
I definitely would be selling something, you know, that I might have had a nice profit in, and raising a little cash. Longer term, I'd be looking for high-yielding situations, and you can still find them. I think if we were to have this sell-off, you're going to have a heck of a nice buying opportunity at some point. You know, you and I will have to talk about what that point is in future meetings, but I don't want to be in the camp of the super bears. I guess it goes against my nature, but I can't totally discount what they're talking about. Now, that would mean the Dow going below that February low of 15,450 or 15,500. That would be a real catastrophic sell-off. So what I would say in conclusion is, yeah, I'd raise a little cash. I wouldn't be too aggressive here. Maybe a little more conservative. And wait till that decline, if indeed it does materialize, wait till we feel more comfortable that it's over. And not until then. And whenever we feel that we've finally made a bottom, hopefully it's at 16,000 or 17,000, whatever. Hopefully it's there. Then I'd definitely come back in.
So right now, as we conclude, Ralph, you wouldn't go 100% in cash, would you?
No, I don't think so. You know, if I think of my wife, Rosemary, a wonderful lady. She handles our money, and she used to be with Wells Fargo, a great financial advisor. And in our situation, we're going to ride it out because, you know, I'm 75 years old, and we have dividends. So we understand market's going to be very volatile, but we're not going to sell our American Telephone or, you know, something like that. We're going to ride it out. If you're in that situation, I think you ride it out instead of trying to time the purchases and sales. And that's how I view myself. But I'm in quality names, so I'm not junk.
Yeah, so if you have a high-quality stock, Coca-Cola, Procter & Gamble, that are giving you nice dividends, better than what you can actually get in the bond market, and those dividends are going up a year, I mean, it's amazing. I give the example, Ralph, if had you bought Coca-Cola January of 2008, by March of 2009, your stock was down a third during the financial crisis, which could be quite scary. But during that whole period of time, though, Coca-Cola raised their dividend in 2008, 8%. In 2009, they raised it another 8%. And by the end of the year of 2009, Coca-Cola was back to where you started. In the meantime, your dividends went up 16%.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, that's exactly my personal position. But not everybody's 75 years old.
Okay, final comment. Gold has been one of the star performers this year. Gold is up, silver is up, and the gold stocks almost look parabolic. What's your take on gold?
I like it. You know, this is the first time I can say in quite a few years that I think gold is finally bottom. Sure, you'll have little periods of correction and all that. If you're so inclined to buy gold, take advantage of any kind of weakness and add to your positions or start a position in gold. Yes. And I just put out on the Twitter that crude looks like it's bottomed for me. And, you know, I could see crude in the low 50s at some point.
It's amazing. Everything else isn't doing well. The thing that got beaten up for such a long time is the star performer, but that's usually the way the markets work. Well, listen, Ralph, as we close, if our listeners want to follow your work, how could they do so?
I'm on Twitter, and you can follow me there. I usually make a comment every couple of days.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
Mm-hmm. If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program is Professor Wade Pfau from American College. And Professor, let's talk about the retirement tools that people have today, because traditionally, when you take a look at retirement, there's almost two schools of thought in the financial industry. There's one that stresses probability-based, or let's say market-type returns as the best solution for retirement. The other side of the industry comes from safety first, and that's the insurance industry that's saying, no, you're in retirement, you can't afford to take the risk, you're better off securing your income than you are making bets in the market. Let's talk about those two philosophies and how maybe sometimes the better approach is a combination of them.
Right. So the two philosophies, really, from the investment side, there's more of this focus on the idea that stocks outperform bonds over the long term. And that long term is short enough that individuals can really take advantage of that. So they're really focused on the upside growth potential of an aggressive investment portfolio. And on the insurance side, the focus is more on the idea of pooling the risk, and rather than having to bear all the risk. There's so many retirement risks that change once you enter retirement compared to pre-retirement. The longevity, not knowing how long to plan for, the market volatility that gets amplified when you're taking distributions from your investments. And rather than trying to manage all that risk on your own, which really requires being overly conservative with your spending, instead you should pool that risk and rely on some of the subsidization of essentially those who don't live as long, subsidize those who live longer, and that can allow everyone to really enjoy more spending over their lifetime. And so it's that belief that the stock market's going to outperform versus a belief that you can't really rely on stock market outperformance, that risk really gets amplified more in retirement and you should pool some of that risk.
Well, recently, the economic data has been weakening, but the Fed is still talking about possible rate increases. Is the economy really slowing down, or is it about to improve? Well, we're going to look at that and get in the weeds today with my guest, Greg Weldon. And Greg, you did a piece in your Global Macro lately, which I was glad to see you pick up on a trend that we're seeing. You know, you look at charts, I look at charts, we look at economic data. And when you get numbers 1 month, you might say, well, okay, that's one number. What we look for is in trends. And if you look at the economy, it peaked in the second quarter of last year at close to 4%. It slowed down in the third quarter, slowed down further in the fourth quarter, and slowed down even more in the first quarter. Now, to me, that's a trend. So that's the economy. Now, let's talk about the economy in the sense of the consumer, because 70% of GDP is consumption. Let's talk about your consumer comfort index. Tell our listeners what this index is and what it's showing right now.
Well, it's actually the Bloomberg Consumer Comfort Index. It's a weekly number. It's pretty broad-based. It's timely, so I like to follow it. And what it's showing us recently is a souring, actually, of sentiment among a specific group of people, and that is basically middle-aged men that live in the Northeast that are full-time employed and are higher income earners. So, you know, in terms of kind of the erosion of some sentiment, I think that that would be a group that you would least want to see, you know, have a souring opinion as to their comfort. And that is directly linked less so to their personal situation, but more so to the broader economic picture and outlook. So I found that to be really interesting. It's a trend that is kind of developing over the last 6 to 8 weeks. So it's definitely something to keep an eye on, particularly in light of today's retail sales numbers, which kind of belie some of what you're seeing in other indicators, specifically commentary from retailers themselves. I mean, you look at the retail sales number, you know, it was automobile, online sales, and gasoline. Outside of that, there wasn't a heck of a lot of growth momentum. So, you know, the Fed consistently talks about improvement yet to come. as the, you know, premise upon which they are, you know, basically plotting their path for interest rate hikes this year and next. But whenever you even hear hawkish comments from Fed members, it seems to always be prefaced with the word if. If we get the growth we expect, then we're on track to do what we say we're going to do. So it's still kind of a waiting game. I think this week has been interesting because you have a retail sales number that doesn't look so bad, but that it kind of it goes against the grain of other numbers you've seen. And if you look at the reaction in the market today to that retail sales number, it's hardly what you would call robust. The consumer shares, the consumer ETFs continue to look very vulnerable to me. And without job growth, without wage growth, and the job market to me looks like it's rolled over, it's going to be difficult to see how you're going to generate enough momentum to kind of meet the Fed's criteria.
Yeah, because there are a number of indicators out there. The Wall Street Journal recently did a study on the housing market, and they called it the tale of two markets. On the very, very, very low end of the market, you put a house up for sale, it goes and sells very quickly, sometimes over listing price. But in the high end part of the market, that's already peaked. Homes are staying on the market for a much longer period of time. They're selling at discounts from listing value. And if you're looking at the political campaign, depending on, you know, whose side you're looking at, one side is saying, hey, if we're elected, we're going to raise your taxes even more. The market hasn't done much of anything in terms of the stock market since the fall of 2014. So if you're Larry Lots of Bucks and you're looking at the market over the last 15 months and you're looking at the political campaign, you're paying high taxes as we do in California, and the candidates are saying, we're even going to take more of your income. What are you thinking?
Well, I mean, I think that it's a scary outlook, and that's why you do probably see some of this sentiment eroding on the consumer side, because the outlook is cloudy, to say the least. I think from the political perspective, whether it's a liberal tax and spend dynamic or whether it's a, you know, the Republican candidate comes in with a protectionist mindset, I think either one of those are extremely negative possibilities and prospects going forward. So I think that for sure there's some dynamic around that in terms of the sentiment. As it relates to increasing taxes and as it relates to the housing market, I can tell you for sure here in Florida, I live in a fairly, you know, it's a growing area in Palm Beach County here in Florida. It's a fairly affluent area. It's high end communities. The prices have gotten completely out of control again. And that's just happened fairly quickly to where we really, I think they're extremely overvalued. You are getting so much less for your money than you were 3 or 4 years ago when it was actually a buyer's market. So I think that you've priced out a lot of home buyers. You've certainly priced out first-time home buyers. You've had a big migration into states with less tax, which tells you, you know, exactly what people think about this whole idea of increasing taxes. You're threatening to put the consumer in a cocoon with this kind of talk. If the Fed were to, you know, continue to talk hawkishly, when you talk about the stock market, though, Jim, I got to say, it's exactly what you said. It's flat. There is zero return to be had, to be found in the stock market. And if you do the overlay that we do all the time, which is essentially the Fed's balance sheet, the consumer, i.e. retail sales, and the stock market, it's the same exact chart. So since the Fed stopped expanding their balance sheet, stock market's gone sideways and retail sales is essentially flat. It actually fell a little bit more and it's kind of coming back. So it's playing a little bit of catch up in this most recent report, but I don't look at this report as a sign of inherent strength or as something that gives me hope that there's momentum building in the consumer. The consumer has saved some money. And as a result of that, you see spending, you know, particularly in the internet area, the non-store retailers. I watch gasoline versus eating and drinking establishments. The sales of those two things are negatively correlated. And you can see it right here with gas prices going up. You've already seen you got 2 months of increasing gas prices, which have increased the amount of money consumers are spending at the gas station and is directly being drawn out of spending that had been phenomenal growth. About $3 for every $3 saved at the gas pump, consumers were spending two of those dollars in eating and drinking establishments. You're getting almost the exact reverse ratio now where it's about, you know, every $2 you have to spend at the gas station, you know, it's about a dollar being drawn out of eating and drinking establishments. When I talk about discretionary spending, when I think of discretionary spending, that's probably one of the biggest tells is how people approach going out and going out to dinner, going out to bars. You know, I mean, to me, that is kind of the margin of the consumer's discretionary spending right there. And that is not looking particularly healthy. And when you link that back to the labor market, you know, it shows you why. You don't have the wage growth you need to sustain a healthy reflation. You've had it in housing. I think that is peaked. I think it's rolling over. And I think that that's a problem as it relates to sentiment going forward, too. I mean, you have the employment market rolling over. You have the housing market rolling over. And you're looking at two political candidates, which bring a lot of, you know, negative sound bites economically in terms of the outlook. Again, I don't see how it's going to be a momentum-driven growth dynamic in the consumer that then, you know, applies to the stock market. I just don't see it. I see the same thing kind of sideways and going nowhere in stocks, in the consumer, and essentially from the Fed as well.
Well, let's talk about the Fed, because we spent all last year, the consensus when we began 2015 is the Fed would go in June. We know they didn't. Then the consensus shifted over to September. They didn't go then. And then finally, they did that one quarter point in December, not realizing, you know, the Atlantic Fed said that in terms of tightening, they really did tighten when you take a look at what happened to credit spreads, what happened to the dollar. So here we are in 2016. They came off the December rate hike, talking about four hikes this year, one a quarter. And then they sort of went soft in January. Then Janet Yellen on February on Capitol Hill went softer. And then the FOMC meeting in March said, well, maybe two. The futures market right now, Greg, assigns very little probability in June. And yet we've had some well-known bond fund managers, people like Bill Gross, Mohammed El Arian. We had Dudley saying, well, maybe June is on the table. I just don't see it. I pay more attention to the futures market, which tends to get it right 80-90% of the time versus what the Fed is predicting. So if they don't go in June, which I don't think they will with Brexit in the economic data that you and I are just talking about, and I don't know if they would even do that in September. In other words, the economy is going to have to heat up at almost a 3% growth rate every single quarter to hit the Fed's target. And for the life of me, Greg, I'm looking at the economic numbers. I don't care if it's manufacturing, ISM, service. I don't see anything that's going to hit that number. Do you?
No, I really don't. And I think, you know, you bring up a really interesting point in terms of the Fed's dot plot and their projections versus the market pricing in the Fed funds futures. The Fed funds futures has gotten it way closer to right than the Fed has. And right now, if you had looked back 2 years we rewind the clock here, and you look at where the Fed was saying we would be now, they would have hiked rates to 2% or higher already by now, which clearly has not happened. So it's been one of these things where, you know, to me, a lot of this is verbalization. I mean, it's kind of verbalized policy now where they worked a dot plot, which in fact did impact the futures market. You were, you know, pricing in tightening by now in the futures market a year ago. They've depriced it, of course. But to me, it's almost like that depricing has kind of been an easing that has kind of helped the economy to some degree because there's no policy symmetry. The Fed very often talks about symmetry of policy. In other words, if we have another downturn here, okay, we want to have ammunition. So I think a lot of what's going on is some actual anxiety at the Fed that if you get a downturn, they want to have ammunition to fight that, and they don't have as much as they might if Fed funds were, say, at 1%. So, you know, it's interesting to look at that. And then we're not even talking about a very simple dynamic that I think is critical going forward. It's one of these things, watch what you ask for, you just might get it. And that is energy. That is gasoline prices. Last year, gasoline prices peaked in June at about $2.20 a gallon. Okay. You had another big decline in the futures market to below a dollar. You've now rallied back to about $1.60. All you have to do is stay right here. You don't even have to rally any further. And by August, September, you're going to have a year-over-year increase in gasoline prices that's going to push the headline CPI number closer to the core. The core number is not far from the 2% target for PCE inflation. The Fed has told us a consistent spread would be CPI at 2.5 to get your PCE at 2. Well, you might actually see CPI at 2.5 in the fall, and maybe sooner if gasoline prices were to rally. Now, if that puts the Fed in a position where, hey, we have said all along, if you get a push towards our inflation goal, we're going to be hiking rates. Well, is a pushing gasoline prices, that's a mathematical kind of dynamic versus year ago basis factor, enough to push the Fed to hike rates? All right, when gasoline prices rising would only, you know, kind of put the crimp into the consumer in terms of discretionary spending, because you don't have wage inflation, you don't have stock market feel good reflation, you don't have wealth reflation at all. So from that perspective, what does the Fed do then? They get what they want, which is inflation moving up towards their goal. They have to respond to that. But in fact, both of those things, first of all, you know, if energy were to rally, and then second of all, if the Fed were to hike rates, would be deflationary for the consumer. So I think it's a very tricky, it's a tightrope walk for the Fed, and they've done a phenomenal job. I don't envy them their job, but I think that there is some credibility, and I'm not saying I agree with it, but there is credibility to the thought that you kind of might want to get out ahead of this a little bit and give yourself some room to where you're not in a box forced to raise rates and push a deflationary wave out there versus, okay, maybe if we hike now and you know, we get ahead of it, and then we have something to use on the back end if you see a slowdown start to develop. So, you know, it's a tough one, and it's like walking the tightrope, you know, over the Niagara Falls. I mean, you tip too far one way, you fall into a, you know, deflationary dynamic. You push too far the other way, and, you know, you could actually see some inflation on the rise, and that might be the Fed's worst-case scenario. So I don't know. I mean, it's a really tough thing to handicap right now, that's for sure.
Yeah, because when I look at the economic data, when the Fed started first with taper, and you notice when taper ended, as you and I talked, that's when the stock market stopped going places. And then I take a look at, you know, their attempts last year to raise rates. I'm looking at the economic data, and I'm trying to think, what are you guys seeing? And the only justification I could come up with is, hey, we know down the road we're going to have another recession, another bear market. We want to put some bullets in the chamber is the only excuse that I could come up to. Now, let's go to two other topics. I want to talk about the dollar. Last year, when the Fed was tightening vociferously, especially in the open mouth committee, about raising rates, the dollar strengthened, and then we got up, almost looked like a double top. Now they've kind of pulled back. Things have picked up a little bit better overseas, and the dollar is in a weakening trend. Let's talk about the dollar and the implications for precious metals.
Well, I think it's really interesting that you see some of the hawkish commentary coming from the Fed when the dollar was literally like the same day. It's within 24 hours almost, to where the dollar was testing and actually violating key technical support on a long-term basis that would have brought what you're talking about, the double top, okay, above 100 in the dollar index, which also, by the way, happens to be a perfect 61% retracement of the entire bear market in the dollar from 2000 to 2008. So from a very long-term technical perspective, the dollar's rally has been something of a correction that was predicated upon the Fed's dot plot. So, you know, I think that the Fed also understands, you know, if we hike rates, we don't want the dollar to make new highs because it's going to impact emerging markets. It's going to impact you know, commodities, and it actually works against them achieving their goals. So that's on the one hand. But here on the other hand, you don't want to see the dollar necessarily come off too hard, too fast, because then that would boost gasoline prices and commodities. And then you put yourself in a position where, you know, mathematically and from a statistical standpoint, you're going to have a rise in CPI numbers, which then puts the Fed in a real tough position where they have to hike more. And that might lift the dollar more. And like I said before, that's exactly why I said it too. You hike rates, lift the dollar. It brings a deflationary wave in commodities and emerging markets. They know they can't afford it. So they are walking a fine line here as well in terms of the dollar, because it really holds the key. When you come to precious metals and the commodity sector, it's the exact flip side of this. Okay. You've had almost a perfect 50% retracement in the gold market. It was a 12-year bull market, a 4-year correction. It was an ABC pattern to the 50% retracement. From a long-term perspective, gold looks very well positioned here, and it mirrors the dollar on the flip side, which looks like, yes, a bearish trend could come into play. It's probably something that the Fed might even look at as a tool they have. And we said this, in November, December, and in our January year ahead outlook piece that the dollar would come into play this year, that the Fed would bring it back into play because they know that they have to. I mean, of course, we could talk for hours about competitive currency depreciations because basically nobody wants their currency to strengthen. And when the dollar was weakening, you look at places like, Denmark and Sweden and places where they've cut rates to deeply negative levels specifically to keep their currencies from rising. So, you know, man, again, it's just so much going on, such a tough environment for the Fed to operate in. But I think it was really interesting when you saw hawkish commentary coming from the Fed the very minute that the dollar was threatening key support, because while they might want to work it lower, they don't want to see it really come off too hard too fast because of the potential impact on commodities. One thing I will point out about the metals and energy, by the way, and the agricultural commodities also seem inherently bullish here with some underlying strength that kind of belies what we see in the speculative community, which is huge long positions. I mean, in silver, in gold, and in crude oil, the long positions are as large as they've ever been. So that is a little bit of a concern. When you take, you know, kind of the Fed picture in mind, they want to get some bullets back in the chamber. I think it's a perfect analogy. You could get a scenario here where, you know, the Fed moves, the dollar rallies, the energy and metals get hit. But I think if that happens, you're waiting below the market in the metals and energy with both hands ready to buy any significant dip that comes about on a speculative liquidation.
So we have some pronouncements from some pretty smart guys, Bill Gross, Mohammed El-Erian, a couple others. They're saying, telling the markets, don't get too complacent, even though the futures market says the unlikelihood of, let's say, a June rate hike. Could, in your opinion, Greg, let's say we get a little pickup in the economic numbers or something happens, that they go and say, well, let's see if we can get one more in and just kind of sit back after that? Because I think as we get closer to the election, politically, I mean, when the president calls the Fed chairman to the White House, I assume they didn't want to play, bridge. There's a reason that she was called to the White House.
Well, I know. I mean, in terms of the political season, it just adds another big question mark and a lot of uncertainty around, you know, it makes the Fed's job that much more difficult. The thought process I have around them moving in June and wanting to, you know, kind of get out ahead of it, get ahead of the election, get ahead of, you know, gasoline prices potentially on a calendar basis, that the futures market is indeed not pricing in a rate hike. So what would happen if they did move? It would be a surprise. It would lift the dollar. One of two things would happen. It'd be interesting to see. I mean, whether the dollar actually rallies because it's a surprise, or whether, you know, you actually get the reverse, buy the rumor, sell the fact type of thing, where it's like, wow, they just hike rates here. They can't do it again this year. And the fallout may actually be kind of more towards the negative side. So, gosh, I don't know. I don't expect them to hike rates, but I would not be betting my life on it. That's for sure.
Yeah, because, I mean, so many things have been uncertain in this market. In fact, Greg, I would say we've almost entered, you know, the 80s and 90s, maybe the early part of the last decade, were called the Great Moderation. I would say we're entering into the period of great uncertainty. We have the uncertainty constantly weighing on the market. Will they or will they not raise rates? So the Fed is still talking about it, even though they use, as you point out, if is a big word. And then on top of that, you have political uncertainty. And then if you look at events in the Middle East, I don't care, or even in Europe, wherever you're looking, or in China or in Japan, there's a lot of uncertainty in this kind of market. So it's more of, I would say, an active market, because when we get these risk on, risk off rallies, they tend to be fast and furious. I mean, if you take a look at the market coming out of those February lows, I don't care if it was commodities, bond spreads on junk bonds, it happens quickly and then it reverses. It's a very volatile time.
Because you have stretched everything to the max. I mean, this is not something that has been happening just recently. I mean, this is the ongoing trend that you can take back decades if you want. I mean, I like to market to the simple, you know, starting point, and it's not the starting point, but it's a good mark to, you know, really kind of define things to when we went off the gold standard back in early 70s, 1970, 71, whenever it was. This is a continuation of all of that. I'll tell you what, let's look at one place where you have phenomenal growth. Phenomenal growth, government debt. Okay. No one talks about it anymore. Okay. you had this amazing opportunity with low rates, particularly in Europe, to kind of pay down some debt, reduce debt. This is what they said they were going to do. They haven't done it. I mean, I think it's only Germany. I think there's only two or three European countries out of the 27 EU member nations that have actually reduced debt from 2009. Most of them have increased debt, and in many, many cases, to record levels, i.e. Italy, Belgium, another case in point. I mean, AAA rated, but on a per capita population basis, Belgium has more debt than Italy does. And then just look at the U.S. I mean, you've gone from, you know, 9 trillion to 19 trillion, and nobody talks about this anymore. So to me, this is all just the same story. You keep stretching everything. What's going to happen in Europe if interest rates rise? Oh my gosh, you have a disaster waiting to happen. One of the phrases I like to use frequently these days, and particularly applies to Europe in bonds, it applies to Japan for sure in terms of the BOJ's balance sheet, which is now growing parabolically. It also now even applies to China with corporate debt. Something's gotta give. You have stretched this to the max. You know, I don't see how you can continue to stretch this to the same degree that you have over the past several years, because QE is losing its effectiveness. Case in point is Japan for sure. So from that perspective, this is why it is so tenuous, so uncertain, so back and forth, because you're on the cusp of something's got to give. When that happens, I don't know. I mean, it's been, you know, perpetually pushed back further and further and further and further into the future. But at some point, there's a day of reckoning out there. And I think, you know, this is the kind of thing that keeps people awake at night in terms of thinking about long-term generational type of future for the economy, for the dollar, you know, for the entire ball of wax globally. It's not a pretty picture. So we can't forget that. But the level of complacency here, because of QE, because of central banks, is nothing less than mind-boggling. So from that perspective, of course it's uncertain. Of course things are fractured and stretched to either side of the spectrum, because they are stretched to the max on either side of the spectrum. So this also makes it somewhat, almost perversely, exciting to get up in the morning and to see what every day is going to bring, because every day can be dramatically different from one day to the next. You don't see a lot of, you know, longer term trends. It's become more difficult to handicap. It's become more difficult to trade. So I think this is where, you know, we've been successful this year because we've been bullish on the commodity sector. And that's been a really good play. I mean, in our trade lab, which is part of our daily research, I mean, we got trades in the ags, we got trades in fixed income, we got trades in foreign exchange, we got trades in metals, we got trades in energy, all of which are producing very large returns. But that is also a function of the fact that you had such a bearish move in the last 3 years. So, you know, from that perspective, too, you've stretched everything to the max, and now you're getting a little push the other way. You know, it'd be interesting to see how this plays out, because for me, the rest of this year is going to be more of this real uncertainty, real day-to-day dynamics that are night and day. I mean, it's exciting, but it's also scary.
Well, listen, Greg, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, tell them how they can do so.
Sure, they can come and get a free trial to our research product at weldononline.com, and that's one word, weldononline.com. Our product is Weldon Live. It's a daily 8 to 12 minute video where we do charts, and you don't see me, gosh forbid, I have to be presentable every day, but it's charts. I walk you through macro, fixed income, foreign exchange, stock indexes and ETFs, metals, energy and ags. We do it every day. We have the daily video. We have a chart pack, which gives even broader coverage in each of those sectors. And then we have the trade lab, and we've actually just kind of reduced our prices. So I think right now, the way we've kind of retooled our product to make it very usable and very affordable, I think we're providing real value with our research right now. And I welcome all of your listeners to come and check it out.
I think the one question we could ask during the big picture, which is coming up next year on the Financial Sense News Hour, it's a good one too, by the way. Where are we? We keep talking about the economy possibly turning down into a recession, but the real question is, judging from where we are right now and some of the anemic responses of various economic indicators, is this as good as it gets. We have to look at the economy slowing down since the second quarter of 2015, and now the labor market is showing signs of weakness and the equities are faltering. What does all of this mean? Can you actually put sense into the whole thing? Speaking of making sense of something, the debt super cycle seems to be that we are at the end of a debt super cycle. So when they do end, what kind of territory do you find yourself in? And if you're an investor, what can you do? All of that coming up next on The Big Picture with Jim and John as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.